So tonight we're doing the third leg of our Trinity thinking journey. And the model, just to summarise very briefly, is a Trinitarian model for growth that we can actually find in the structure of the Trinity, a really balanced diet as Christians. And the model we've used is a Trinitarian model called, it's down the right here, it's working. No, it's out of battery, so I'll have to give up on that. The normative, the situational and the existential. And this is a model that Mark introduced me to years ago. And it's a model that says on any particular situation or any particular question, I can look at it from three angles. And rather than saying I have to have one angle and not the other, I can take all three. So the model began, I think, as an ethical model. And if one were to ask an ethical question such as, is gambling right or wrong? And that's a vexed question. And most people want a simple answer. Tell me yes or tell me no. And of course, we feel boxed in by that kind of binary thinking. What this model says is, well, I could look at that question from three perspectives, and actually, if I'm wise, I'll look at it from all three, not one of the three. The normative model would indeed say there are some transcendent principles here that are true, are universally true, and we should take those into account. And so that would try to speak some normative principles. It could have things to do with, well, greed is wrong. We should get reward only with effort. These are principles that should be true for all time. The situational model would then say, yeah, that's true, but tell me, what's your job in life? Are you an investment banker or are you running a casino or are you a problem gambler? Because to be honest with you, I'm going to talk, depending on your situation, I'm going to answer that question differently, because I could define investment banking as gambling. And so that would be the situational angle. And the existential angle would tend to pay attention to your conscience. Look, no matter what I say, if this makes you feel really burnt up, take notice of that. So you put the three together, and they're three rich angles onto any particular situation. They map onto the Trinity in that the normative is very much the role of the Father, who is in the Bible, always the holder of purpose and universal truth. The situational, which is I'm incarnate in the situation, maps very much onto Christ, who came into our situation and lived in our situation and worked in our world. And the existential maps onto the Holy Spirit, because that's the job of the Holy Spirit, is to take great truths and make them live inside of our souls, hearts. So what we're saying is that this is actually a very powerful... This model not only maps onto the character of the Trinity, but we can use it to grow. And we've made the point that the normative would be the traditional kind of heavy doctrine. There's a truth out there, learn it school, which is very, I suppose, Sydney Anglicanism is very strong. But the criticism will be, well, that's all very dry, and there's no passion, there's no leading of the Holy Spirit, etc., which will be more of a charismatic emphasis, which is existential. And then, the Wesley Mission or the Salvation Army would say, that's all very well, but what are we doing for the poor, which is very situational. And rather than saying one of these is wrong or one of these is right, I actually think it's the Trinity is telling us. And this is a wonderful thing about Christianity. It's a very dialogical framework at the heart. It's not a monotheistic, monolithic framework. One of the great differences with Islam, it's very much a normative, that's all religion. So there's no place for compromise, no place for give and take and flex. But the heart of our faith is a Trinitarian model of relationship, which does say, look, life's more complex than you think. There might not be easy answers. And that's actually mapped into the character of God. So we've talked about the normative journey, which is essentially, it's my job to feed myself with the big picture of what God has done. And that's my job in life, and I think growth begins there. getting into my head. Stuff like listening to John Walton, to me, would be normative. I get a much better understanding of God's project, and it's my job for my life to be continually expanded on that axis. Last time we did the situational, which is how I design my life to act in the world, and it's probably the area where I think Christianity's generally been weakest. And last time we talked, we reframed that as an act of design and transformation, that the job that I think we're called upon as Christians is to have a transformative influence, not just in churches, but just generally in society. Tonight is the existential, which is the inner journey. So, first of all, let me explain why the inner journey matters. I mean, really, to me, it really matters. The first thing is authenticity, which is matching my inner convictions with my outward voice. And there's a huge danger in life, and the more I've gone on, I've seen, frankly, things that stunned me in terms of people having a public position around faith and then virtually giving it up, or just, yeah, virtually giving it up, or actually doing things that I thought were just unconscionable. I now think that what happened was that their public position was perhaps accelerating, but their inner journey was not. So we have to actually have an inner journey as well as a public journey. Because in life, life will be a journey of decisions and events, and people will be seeing us going publicly, and if we're a Christian, that will have a public position with our faith. But inside our heads, inside our hearts, we're watching ourselves the whole time. We're looking at ourselves and we're wondering about stuff. And the inner journey often is more painful than the outward journey. And so you can run the risk of just those things being pulled apart, because if my inner journey is about some pain or some doubt, I fear that I shouldn't talk about that, so I can get a kind of a schizophrenia. However, what we do know in life, is the more we bring of ourselves to public positions, the more powerful we are. That if I can join those lines, all people of influence who had the power to influence other people seemed to be able to pull something out of their souls when they spoke. It wasn't disembodied, it wasn't objectified. I have for years had inspiration from Joshua, who is really, to me, the first general in the Bible, an absolute man of action. And I felt God speak to me time and again from these words that, okay, you're going to be doing incredibly bold, adventurous things, but this book of the law will never depart from your heart and your mouth. You'll meditate on it night and day. So he was commanded to have this inner journey to kind of buttress the outer journey. Abraham Lincoln was, anyone see the movie out recently? Mm-hmm. It's a real hero of mine, and Lincoln was famous for being a ponderer, famous for being apparently a slow decision maker. Now, when he made decisions, he made them, but if he wasn't ready, he wouldn't make them. So that takes courage to be, you know, and I think there were some scenes in that film where everyone is saying from all sides, you know, make it, do something, do something. I know I'm not ready to do it. Because he had this incredible sense of connection with his own soul. He was a really introspective, deep man, and he had to come to terms in his own heart with stuff. So this inner journey is really important from that point of view. It just makes us in our relationships much more authentic. Second reason is the affections. I've been using Jonathan Edwards quite a lot in these talks. And Edwards wrote a whole book on what he called the affections. It was not good to have head knowledge. One had to have a heart won over to God, which essentially is the devotional response to God. Just love God. That is, it is something which must balance propositional understanding, the love of God. So the danger in life is that we can just get head knowledge and acquire a normative understanding without the affections of our heart being engaged. We are engaged in the greatest love story that's conceivable. and most of the metaphors that the Bible chooses to speak about the Father's heart toward us are incredibly tender. And so it's got to have that response for us. The normative journey should inform our devotion to the Lord. And that's very important because I think that the more one knows about what God has done, the more our devotion gets educated, but equally the education then breathes life into the normative. And we know that this is what God wants. Psalm 40 famously said that what God, that sacrifice and offering he didn't desire. He said, my ears have you pierced, I desire to do your will, your laws are within my heart. God was disinterested, the prophet was saying, absolutely disinterested in the outward show. His whole agenda was to get something written on our hearts. That is his whole game, is to make everything existential, experienced. Deuteronomy, which I've mentioned, I mean, what's always stunned me about Deuteronomy, it's like after all the laws of Leviticus and Numbers, the framing of Deuteronomy is Moses actually saying that all this is to do with your affections, that you'll love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul and mind. And an extraordinary statement. And finally, and this is the one we'll probably build on most tonight, is learning and self-knowledge as to why the inner journey matters. So I guess what I've seen in life is that some people just don't learn. They remind me of a tree that as a sapling is malleable and can be bent, but as it gets older, those twisted shapes get distorted and get cemented in, and then they can't change. And as I've looked at people who seem in life to be really wise, I suppose the number one capacity seems to be their ability to grow and their ability to learn. So this is the part of the journey I want to focus on tonight, that we see the capacity for self-reflection. The US Army did analysis on leaders some time ago, and as to what quality people most look for in leaders, what came out was quite counterintuitive. That was self-knowledge. That people wanted leaders who had the capacity to reflect and who knew themselves. I love the story of David and Nathan. You know, when Nathan tells David the story about the adultery, and he actually objectifies it in the third person, and then David says, this is a terrible person, and Nathan says, that's actually you. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but I've kind of had the Holy Spirit take me through that. It's actually you I'm talking about here. Thou art the man. And I think the example of Jesus and his priestly role on earth is really important. So what I'm going to position ourselves with now is that learning and development happens completely independently of sin. Very important to get this idea in your head. So I remember years ago Sarah asking a question on the Bible studies, my daughter, can God learn? Which I'd never thought of before, and of course my instinct was to say no, because if I say no, you've got to say no, because he's perfect and he's omniscient. I think the answer is yes. It's biblically yes, because what we see about Jesus is learning in Hebrews is applied very explicitly to Jesus. So we know Jesus was without sin, but it says in Hebrews that he learned obedience by what he suffered. This is something about incarnation, life on earth. Something about the condition we're in, living on earth, is that we won't know everything. So I'm sure when Jesus was 10 or 8, he did not know everything. He did not know everything about the Bible. He was going on a journey of discovery. He learned from what he suffered, where there was, in a sense, reactions he didn't predict and didn't want. And that learning became the source of his power with others. So I think we need to take this pretty seriously, that it is quite clear that the Son of God learned and developed. And therefore it's quite clear that learning, God can learn, and God does learn, and God does develop in the incarnational situation. So we're just So therefore, we have a pathway of learning that clearly exists without sin. Does that make sense for everybody? Pretty important, because I think a lot of the times we would tend to think of learning as something that's, to some degree, getting rid of sin. So that's three reasons why the inner journey matters. I'll pause there and ask if there's any questions or comments before I go on to develop this theme a bit more.
For a lot of people, those statements in Hebrews there often just they don't sound right.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if that's for anybody, you know, there's a that sense it's worth just worth naming, you know, talking about a little bit. It just doesn't sound right, does it? You know, it doesn't sound right to the picture of Jesus I had since I was a little boy, you know, growing up Sunday school sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. That Jesus learns obedience, that he becomes perfect. That's not the picture I had. But it's really important, so I just think it's worth pausing for anybody that's sort of greats or something.
Another clue is the number of times he says he's talking to the Father to understand the Father's heart, what the Father's doing.
Yes.
He inquires of the Father what he's doing, so part of it.
So inquiry was part of his life, he had to inquire, yeah.
And what did Joshua's father do? Joshua's father inquired of the Lord about the Molly Brent of Conley, Joshua's people, and the thing.
You've lost me on that one day.
You have to just check on Joshua.
Yeah.
What the consequence would for generations, because they didn't inquire of the Lord.
But I'm just interested in the idea of Jesus learning, and is that a fresh idea for people?
Does that mean that there came a point in time that he realised that he was the Son of God? What time was that?
My strong speculation is when he was a child and they left him behind at the temple. That was actually the Passover.
Mm-hmm.
And so they both parents thought the other ones had him, and so they left him there. Reminds me of one of the darker days in our lives as parents. Which is when we left one of our kids in the car all night. We were kind of young and had too many children, and we both thought the other one had taken. Anyway, Rebecca thinks she's permanently scarred, and I'm sure there's a lawsuit pending. She keeps threatening us. Every problem goes back to that. But so it was the Passover, and they came back and found him arguing. And Mark, can you remember? Was he arguing about the Messiah? Was he?
Yeah, he was. Didn't say the Messiah, I don't think. But he was just. Everyone was amazed when he was a boy in the temple, and he just said, "I had to be, you know, had to be in my father's house to his parents."
I suspect that if that was the case, this is what I'm imagining is happening then, is that he's clearly extremely learned in the scriptures, and he's clearly read Isaiah 53, and he's read about the suffering servant, and he's looking at the Passover, and I think the penny is dropping that this is the Messiah must suffer and die, and beginning to emerge that I am the Messiah. At some point he had to learn that.
Was that 12?
Just a guess. I mean, we're not told, but we know for sure he didn't know when he was 18 months old, right?
Yeah.
And he didn't know when he was 4. I mean, he committed himself to a developmental path by having a life on earth. So he had to learn things like us. So he knows what it's like for us to have to learn stuff and grow into stuff.
So nobody in that day would have called the temple their father's house?
No. Well, on earth.
Possibly. Yeah, I'm not sure whether he knows, you know, at the temple. The one thing you can be sure of is he knows when he starts his journey. You know.
When he was 30.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Mm. But he must have had a pretty darn good idea a lot earlier than that, I think.
Mm.
Yeah. But at the same time, he had some sense of it's not time yet. Because, you know, 30 is a fair age, you know, you've lived a lot of life and you've had an adult consciousness for quite a long time, but in some sense of it wasn't time yet, so, which, you know, fits this. You know, we might look at it and think, well, hang on, you know, like, you're old enough to go and die sport, like, isn't, you know, what more do you want? Like, get on with it. But that's not the picture you have here. The picture is that all those years of growing and experiencing things are all crucial.
For the purpose of just wanting to be us.
Yeah.
Grace,
so
yeah.
If we talk about just dying and having flesh, what about before he came in flesh? He was like a baby, he was nothing, as a father, and he came in flesh, he didn't have a little bit of knowledge about what he knew already, and then recovering as he grew up.
That's a really interesting area to speculate about. But clearly by becoming flesh and becoming incarnate, he committed himself. He laid aside, it says in Philippians, he laid aside a lot of, let's just imagine, his pre-incarnate powers. What were rightfully his, he voluntarily laid them aside and entered into a life of extreme limitation for him, like by being a baby, by growing up, by being vulnerable to being tired and all the things we're vulnerable to, and essentially entering the regime not just of flesh but also of mortality so that he could die. So there was a huge laying aside of his powers to enter our world within which now he had to learn.
It seems to me that
Yeah, I think that's a fair point.
Maybe.
Good.
I mean, you've got this little phrase in there, once made perfect, right, which gives us this sense of, well, we must be imperfect, you know, to be made perfect, which isn't going to work. And a simple way, because the problem is the picture we have of it, and it's a completely fair translation to use the word mature instead of perfect. And I think it makes a whole lot more sense in this case. So if you think of it in terms of that Jesus has to mature, then it's difficult to conceive of maturity without both the dimensions of the decisions you've made in your life and how you've learned through that and the awareness you've come to of yourself and of all around you. I mean, when Jesus is in the upper room and he's praying for the disciples before he goes, a huge amount of what he's praying is effectively for self-awareness for them, that they'll come to know the Father in the same way that he knows the Father, and therefore that they'll know themselves in that way and how it's worked out in their relationships with each other. He makes that quite explicit, how it flows on to the relationship with each other in a question of love. So I think it is reasonable to say that Jesus is undergoing a process in which he is coming to self-realization, you know, an awareness of just who he is, and that is marked by all kinds of decisions through his life. I mean, I can't imagine that the episode, you know, with Satan, you know, the three great temptations, is the first time he's ever encountered temptation. It certainly wouldn't be the picture Hebrews gives us. But so he's made lots of calls, I would imagine, you know, through his life at different times. But it's things like, you know, he's learned to walk like we learned to walk. You know, there's it doesn't work to have a kind of a magical baby, you know, that sort of, you know, never poos its pants or something, or you know, never throws up or anything, you know, and all of a sudden magically, like, I've hit, you know, the plan is 12 months, get up and walk, bang, I'm up, I'm walking, you know. Do you think, well, that's not incarnate. That's not what we understand it is to be a human being. And it's difficult to conceive of going through all those stages and it not involving you continually to come to a sense of who you are. I mean, that's what marks our lives and our own maturity, is a growing sense of who am I in the world? And I know that in relationship. So there's a sense, I don't think there's a sense for Jesus, you know, we're talking about going from having, you know, no comprehension whatsoever of his father. But it surely grows within him as to what on earth this means and who on earth he actually is. To go back to the earlier question, I mean, I think this is the wonder of the whole thing of the incarnation, is that what happens in Jesus forces us to think in terms of Trinity. We wouldn't have the idea of Trinity except for the incarnation. There's nothing in the Bible that suggests that, you know, there are three persons indivisible, one, you know, one God, three persons, etc., happening before Jesus. As in, you don't get scriptures talking like that. We've come to infer that, and I think rightly infer that, because we're pushed by the wonder, the miracle of God in the flesh, dead, raised from the dead, ascended, and having to say, my goodness me, you know, all of our thinking has to change now. You know, I have to rethink what it is to be human. I've got to rethink everything, including in the end, I've got to rethink who God is. You know, so the question becomes, what kind of God could enter into flesh? But, you know, we're forced logically to say, you know, prior to the incarnation, there are three persons. And at that point, we're just in pure speculation as to how on earth we describe this. And the best we've ever been able to do is to say, if you say that, you're going to get into trouble. If you say that, you're going to get into trouble. I think we're going to have to say this.
Which isn't very much at all.
Which isn't a lot at all.
So, but what Mark is saying is very, very important, because what we're trying to do in Gospel Conversations is to expand our minds with a bit of a wow factor. And that this you used a phrase which is important, that this changes our view of what it means to be human. Because I've actually argued a lot, we've been looking for a subtitle for Gospel Conversations to, you know, make it a bit less religious, and thought of a good one the other day, Humanising Christianity, which I think is the best candidate. But certainly one of the very strong positions which we would put forward and have for years, and has grown on us in Gospel Conversations, is that to understand the incarnation, so far we've talked about Christ, you know, what he put aside, how he came down, so that we can get it, how could God come to man? You've got to go the other way as well. You've got to get a much higher view of what it means to be a human being and how magnificently, dangerously close to God we are, despite the fall. That then makes it much more possible to imagine the incarnation. It's a kind of a two-way meeting in the middle. So, and the other thing that Mark said that's important, which is really, you know, is that somehow or other, Christ is at the centre of all of these things, mystically and wonderfully, and we'll investigate that a bit further tonight.
Sorry, I'm just going back a little bit. Isn't the thing that when we see Jesus at the wedding at Cana, he said, my time has not yet come. And then a bit later on when he reads the scroll and he says, today is fulfilled. And he now seems to know that it's fulfilled, because he's taken to the top of the cliff to be thrown off, and he just walks through them. He doesn't wait for anybody else to do something or someone to save him. He saves himself.
Yeah.
So it seems quite a big change from...
From then to then, yeah, in his realisation of the time and the situation. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. But certainly, though, I think the main point I'm making remains, we can clearly have a model of development, maturity, whatever it is, that exists without sin. So that's my baseline point.
Tony, I think that the whole aspect of sinlessness is something which is forced on us when we think about Christ. But the problem is that we don't think of development.
Yeah.
We think of development as going through, becoming... You know, getting through these things, and development in a different way forms a very different focus.
It does.
This is why you can find on the website, there's some bit of a talk I did forever ago. I can't remember when it was, but when I talked about the two trees, which is something Tony and I have, you know, played with for a long time, that sense that in Genesis 2 and 3, you know, you have the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life, and the sense for us in which they do represent two topologies, if you like, of what it is to be human, two pictures of what it is to be human. And when we see the first one, the truth, the knowledge of good and evil, we always think, you know, that there's a good bit to that and a bad bit to that. The good bit's good and the bad bit's evil, you know. But the text, the way it unfolds, is saying that both bits are unfortunate. Both bits are unhelpful. It's not the good is good and the evil is bad, but having the knowledge of good and evil is itself the problem.
Mm.
Having the knowledge of good is as much the problem as having the knowledge of evil. Because what it has meant is, therefore, we think of everything in binary terms. Just everything is binary for us. It's right, wrong, it's in, out, it's up, down, it's acceptable, it's unacceptable, it's hit the mark, it hasn't hit the mark. And so we're left with a kind of default mindset that is about performance. You know, there's always some kind of mark, and where have I gone in relation to this mark? Whereas the picture you've got in Genesis 1 and 2 is of the possibility of human beings engaging in an extraordinary relationship with each other and with the non-human world and with God, in which there's the hybridizing of plants and the development of architecture and music and on and on and on and on, the full-blown human experience and interaction with the non-human world in a way that has got no relevance, no reference whatsoever to the question of good and evil. None whatsoever. But you've got learning, you've got this constant experiencing, constant growing, constant maturing. But you're dead right. For us, we just find it so incredibly difficult to unpack that and come back and say, here's a picture of learning. It doesn't have to be complicated because of sin. I mean, I think one of the places you can argue around the other way, but it becomes really obvious, is watching the tangles that so many, I mean, I don't know, Sue and I were part of this when, you know, our kids were little, the tangle that a lot of Christian parents get themselves in. Watching children do all the things that little kids do and loading it up with the question of the kid sinning. Rather than just being able to say, the kid is a kid. It's a little kid that's learning, you know? Learning to do stuff, rather than this evangelical mindset that goes, no, everything that's going on must be sinful somehow. And, you know, rather than going, oh, for heaven's sake, you know, it's a child learning to be a child, you know? So I think as Tony was saying, so much of this is about, well, I guess one of the things we keep coming back to as kind of mantras is that the two big questions you've got to keep asking yourself, who is Jesus, what's he done, and what's it mean to be human? And if you give a bad answer to one, you're going to give a bad answer to the other, and converse. And so you find yourself that, I think, you know, certainly in all the years of theology that I did, there's almost, no one ever says this, but there's almost an assumption of, the further up I place Jesus in my thinking, the further down I must place what it is to be human. And that's just nonsense. It's completely back to front. The biblical picture is they're both exalted.
Mm. Dangerously close to God.
Dangerously close to God.
So let's keep going.
Mm.
This is good stuff. And this does lead on to, Mark's comments lead on to, I think, some of the problem, which... And I'm really going to ascribe this insight to our friend Stuart Piggott, who first drew my attention to this, that the evangelical tradition has had a very weak tradition on the inner journey. So what happened, in essence, was that there was a Protestant vacuum around meditation. Stuart's point to me was that he's talking Luther and co, the reformers, never created any system of meditation that was worth its salt. And into that vacuum, I mean, we have souls, we have a need. Instead, what happened was that propositional truth has dominated the tradition, which was a tremendous achievement. I just think they're wonderful people doing a wonderful thing, but Luther himself probably gave us the answer. Luther said in one of my favourite phrases that human beings are like a drunk man trying to mount a horse. You know, we just can't sit in the middle. We're up over the other side and over the other side, and it's kind of like this reaction, counter-reaction. And we can well understand why propositional truth was so important, but it left a gap. And the propositional truth really encouraged the idea of truth being out there. It's out there in the text and the doctrine. That's where the argument is. It's not in here. There's not a debate about the inner truth, whereas the that a lot of the medieval tradition was much more in that space. I think what that has led to, that vacuum of a structured approach to meditation, as far as a lot of evangelicalism is concerned, is an emphasis on triumphant experience. That's what I grew up with as a young Christian. I actually had a phrase, a young Christian, outwardly rejoicing, inwardly screaming. You're just not allowed to have problems. You know, you've got to talk about, and this got into evangelism. I know as young, we had to be, I'm the Christian, I've got to have the answers. You know, I should be the one who's handling life, and I was converted young, so I went through school like this, and having to always be the one who's got it together and so on. You know, it was a burden. But I tell you what, it doesn't work even as an evangelical technique, because nobody likes a smart ass, you know, who's got all the answers. And to be honest, what broke this down for Anne and I was having little kids. We had married young, kids young, 4 kids under 5. I told you what incompetent parents we were. And we were just struggling, you know. We actually went and moved outside of Sydney. That's where we met Mark. But Anne's friends became people who were not Christians, and they were wonderful mothers. And Anne found crying on their shoulder, rather than saying, "I'm a Christian, I've got my act together. Oh my God, I've had a terrible day with the kids. Can you help me?" And guess what? That builds relationships. And guess what? All of those people have come to know Jesus, because we didn't. You know, we were just forced to say we don't. We're not triumphant. Sorry, it's not our experience. But I think the triumphant experience has had this incredible inauthentic sound to it in a lot of Christianity. In essence has left no legitimate place for the dark side. And by the dark side I mean pain, I mean constraints, I mean doubt, I mean dissonance. So the great danger is I can have these things grinding away inside of me. As an example of doubt, when we heard John Walton speak, there was a man beside me who had been a pastor for years, who was looked like he was, say, around about late 60s, 70s, and he just said to John in this voice of incredible gratitude but incredible pain, "I spent like 30 years thinking that I had to believe Genesis literally, and only when I read your book was the kind of tension released." So he had this inner doubt. He's reading it all, but inwardly he doesn't believe it. You know what I mean? And he can't find a space to say, "Ask a question," because I'm not meant to ask questions. You know? So we kind of have got this God of perfection it's a vicious cycle. So does this vicious cycle make some sense to you?
Tony, there's an interesting comment in Mark where it says the disciples were afraid to ask.
Oh, that's it. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, good point, Gordon. Yeah, I can remember that verse. The disciples were afraid to ask.
Whereas think of the contrast of Jesus saying, you know, "Father, you know, is there any other way?
Is there another way?" Yeah, exactly. So what actually did happen was the vacuum was filled, and so the inner journey in the Counter-Reformation was framed by versions of confession, a sin-based journey, and very famously was presented by Ignatius Loyola in the Spiritual Exercises, which were composed in that 20 year between 1520 and 1541. Now, the Spiritual Exercises, which Ignatius Loyola wrote, and I've read tons of, because I believe in going back to primary source material, I've actually read it a lot, so I'm not taking any secondary information about it. The Spiritual Exercises were incredibly influential in one form or another throughout the 16th and 17th century. I first came across them studying literature at university, and in studying John Donne and some of the great poets of the Renaissance, they were structuring their poetry around a meditative framework, an inner journey in the poem, and that's where I first came across Loyola's Spiritual Exercises. But the point about the Spiritual Exercises and this vacuum is that they filled. Let's just look at what he said, because there's some good stuff in this, right? There's some good stuff in this. So this is part of his opening preamble. By the term spiritual exercises is meant every method of examination of conscience, of meditation, of contemplation, of vocal and mental prayer, and of other spiritual activities. For just as taking a walk, journeying on foot, and running are bodily exercises, so we call spiritual exercises every way of preparing and disposing the soul to rid itself of all inordinate attachments, and after their removal, of seeking and finding the will of God in the disposition of our life for the salvation of our soul. Now, understand that this formed the whole of the Ignatian tradition and was hugely dominant in the Western world in the Counter-Reformation. If you've ever seen the movie The Mission, think Loyola. Now, to be fair to Loyola, I think he has an incredibly important point here that's a really good one. It's his exercise. It's got, and I think his comparison to exercises of the body is very apt. We're trainable. And you've got to have discipline. And you've got to work on this stuff. And if you work on it, you'll get rewards. That's what he's saying. So if we are, let's say, sloppy with the journey of our soul, we'll be flabby in our spirits. And I think that's a fair call. It's an incredible duty we have within us, whatever we call soul and spirit, it is in fact the gift of God. And what are we doing with it? To develop it, if we've just said development's important. Or are we treating our souls like a flabby, flabby body that we just never exercise? I think that's good. And I'm going to give you an alternative tonight, an alternative evangelical meditation technique, which I've used for years. So I believe in it. And this will end very practically. And I'm going to quite candidly give you one major journey I went on, but some small ones. What I don't like is the Platonic sin basis of this, which is right there, which is to rid ourselves of all inordinate attachments. This is detoxification and sin spotting. This is excoriation of getting rid of the spots. And my wife, Anne, who was brought up in the Catholic tradition, was given as a young person the metaphor that your soul is like a white sheet of blotting paper when it enters the world, and every sin's a spot. And the spots are filling more and more, you know. And so we think our job, like Lady Macbeth, out damn spot, is can I clean myself? Can I get rid of it all? Because only if I can clean myself of all of this inordinate attachment can I then find the will of God.
Isn't that what you mean? I thought she was always talking about her pet dog.
Yeah. That's right. Mark, Mark, Mark. It's a great literature. No jokes about great literature. The really strong point is the Loyolan exercises are framed and built around sin. And frankly, when I go to the communion service in the Anglican Church, it's a straight Loyolan exercise. Of, you know, since, and I went to, I mean, I love the church that we occasionally attend. I went to a communion service and Anne went too. She kind of was just, had to hose me down. I love it. I love the people. It's just, I love the people there and they're just slashing their wrists for no reason. And they went through the communion. I mean, it was just awful. The whole thing was awful. And she's ex-Catholic, she's telling, well, this is a Catholic Mass, no different. You know, she's got a very astute, precise mind that changed a word or two, but this is a Catholic Mass I'm looking at. And then they had question and answer afterwards, and all these intelligent people are sin-spotting. It was just like navel-gazing around how many sins and what do we do about it. It was just incredible. And it was just, I mean, I was just so scared that a mature, wonderful atheist I might be witnessing to would come along, because he would have, or she would have, every evidence we're pathological. I would have walked out saying, this is sick. You know, it's no wonder that you Christians have got a higher than normal representation in insane asylums if you do this to yourselves the whole time and you theologize, you know, problems. Anyway, you can see I have strong opinions about where this is got to. But let's just look at the origin, because it's really useful, really useful. I like this bit. He said there are three powers of the soul we work on, the memory, the understanding, and the will. I'm not going to go into that, but that's kind of a nice concept. I've got to work on that. But what you did in his system was you had 4 weeks, and they were literally weeks, but they could be longer. So you had a minimum of a month to work on this stuff every day. You often had a facilitator or guide who might talk you through it, but you could do it on your own. This was a system. So week one was meditations on sin and hell, quote unquote. And what was very powerful was visualization. And I like this part of it. I like the composition of time and place, which was in the Renaissance poetry that was emphasized a lot by imagery. You had to get yourself into hell. You had to imagine the fires licking at your soul. And you had to do it for an hour until you were trembling. You had to recall every sin. I don't know if you've ever read the two great examples of this, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce. Anyone remember that book? The incredible sermon in the middle of it on hell that just burned into his heart. But then the other one is In the Name of the Rose. That's a great novel. But do you remember when he was the poor priest is lusting after this attractive 18-year-old girl? And, you know, I'm right there with him, you know. But the therapy was he had to imagine her a corpse. And he had to imagine her body putrefying. And it went on for pages that he had to look at her every time to see a putrefying corpse so that he could have disgust for this sin. This is all the composition of time and place. This is the straight Loyolan technique, because I'll rid myself of it. You get what I mean? So now the next part, I'm actually okay with the rest of it. It's a bad start. So week two is the meditations on the life of Christ. Again, composition of time and place. You know, it's actually quite nice, some of these parts. You imagine yourself there under the tree while he's talking to Zacchaeus and so on. That's all good. And then meditations on the Passion Week, a composition of time and place. And lastly, meditations on the resurrection and the ascension. So, you know, I might quibble a bit with what's inside weeks 2, 3, and 4, but I wouldn't be as strong and vitriolic about it as I am. This all begins with week one. So if you want to know what it looked like, here it is. First in the morning, immediately on rising, one should resolve to guard carefully against the particular sin or defect with regard to which he seeks to correct or improve himself. Secondly, after dinner, which I think was lunch, he should ask God our Lord for the grace he desires to recall how often he has fallen into the particular sin or defect and to avoid it for the future. Now, to make it useful, he actually has a table where you write the sin down. And if it recurs, you write it again, and you write it again, you write it again, you write it again. Rightio. Then follows the first examination. He should demand an account of himself. Let him go over the single hours or periods from the time he arose to the hour and moment of the present examination and make a mark for each time that he has fallen into the particular sin or defect. As I say, this was literally, you had to keep a notebook. So every time. Now, I have enormous definitional problems. Like, is a sin every time I think, you know, if I'm a red-blooded male of a woman or what, a pretty girl, is that a sin? I don't know. Like, is it a sin? Like, if I thought of it, when is once once? Like, how often? Like, if it's 5 seconds, is it one mark? Or, you know, I use incredible definitional problems. But nonetheless, this is obsessive. Okay? This is obsessive. And the idea was that one had to excoriate the sin so that as you progress through the week, you got rid of them. That was the literal idea. So you're keeping a list and the list should get shorter. And you had an inquisitor who often would be, you know, checking on you. Anyway.
There to help.
Now this, as I said, came into the vacuum. Remember what I said, that the evangelical Protestants had a vacuum. They never did anything on the kind of side of justification by faith that was a corollary of this. So as regards the kind of European tradition, if one wanted to have an inner journey and be a pietist, this was what was on offer and became incredibly dominant beyond just people of the Ignatian and Loyolan order. And I would argue has seeped into evangelical Christianity with what, Mark, you were talking about.
Where's Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress fit in time in relation to this?
18th century, 1700s, I think.
Because it's just so similar in some ways.
Yeah, it is. The Puritans have kind of got this stuff. So that's the critique part. I'm now going to go on to the positive part, which is what if we tried something different? And what if we said, could we build some meditation inner journey pathway? around learning from experience. So I've said learning is a godly thing, doesn't require sin, experience is life. What if I said my job for development was to continually learn from experience? And what would that look like? And in which case, my job would become to design my life. My job is not sin spotting. My job is not cleansing myself. I actually have such a radical acceptance of the cross that I know that Jesus has done that job for me. What I'm doing is, however, I am engaged in transformation. I am engaged in growth. I am engaged in development. That's what's taking place. What would it look like? Well, this is the method which I'll recommend and the one that I've used. Firstly, we say that what I'm involved in is the river of life. Experiences, decisions and events. And each of us has a different river, you know, but we share much in common with it, but it's got its own currents, its own directions. Some of it, you know, are directly caused by my past decisions, which create momentum and turns, and some of it's just life events, but I'm in the river, however I got there. And it's throwing up stuff to me regularly, of which I am conscious, unlike any other creature on the planet. Learning begins with dissonance. Noticing. All great learning begins with the dark spot, as I like calling it, the cloudy space. The phrase I often refer to there is John Keats's great phrase of a negative capability. That when human beings learn, we learn by something bothers me, not quite right. So in this particular case, I'm talking about noticing myself as I go through the journey and being somehow or other, you know, dissatisfied with how I'm responding to something. I don't name that as sin. I would name that as a growth. I name it as growth. And the examples I give you will make this plainer. But I then go into a process of trying to explore that. In particular, explore myself. Why am I responding like that? Why am I thinking like that? This is where self-knowledge comes in. I begin to kind of understand myself a little bit and kind of break down frames of myself. And then I, what we call crest the wave, which is I'm looking now for a new element that isn't there at the moment, which I call discovering the divine. There's some sense of possibility, there's some sense of a different way of being, there's some sense of a different way of thinking about this, which is, to me, half from me and half from God. That gives me, wow, that's a different way to think about this. That's a different way to understand and make sense of what I'm going through that can carry me forward, which I then need to take and essentially play out and say, well, I wonder how I would be acting differently. Now, this is what we call in our company, Second Road, the design wave. This is the learning wave, where if I am somebody who has decided to take the good part of Loyola, which is I'm not just going to bob along like a cork floating along the river, you know, well, I'm just not going to do that. I'm going to keep designing my life. That has been my commitment to myself. It's the challenge I put out to people I know. The first object of design in your world must be you. We are shaping ourselves into something. And pretty well, it's in our hands with the help of the Holy Spirit. So this is the model that I'm going to use to talk about a meditation pathway across this process. In a journey. If we did that, if we accepted that model that was on the board, what it would do, it would shift the emphasis from sin to beauty, which is a strange word, but I want to throw it in. So my job is now beauty, not sin. And you might think that's a strange, inconsequential. Beauty, isn't that cosmetic? What's that about? Well, Jonathan Edwards saw beauty as close to the heart of God, and part of the paucity of our theology is that we don't hear that today. He wasn't the only one to see the notion of beauty as absolutely core to the character of God. Beauty has to do with proportion and harmony. It has to do with desirability and joy. It has to do with the sense of the whole, not the parts. A thing of beauty is like a great artist puts things together, and there's a wonderful sense of a meaningful whole. And we shift if something is beautiful from chaos to order. And I've got the word "see" in brackets, because in the book of Genesis, I have a lot of Genesis 1 in my mind as I was writing this. The sea for the Jews was a symbol of chaos. God did not like chaos. He liked order. Order equals beauty. So I could say, well, my job is to make life beautiful. That's actually what I'm doing. I'm making my life more meaningful. And what does I mean by that? Well, rather than my life being incoherent and stuff happening I don't understand and me being out of joint between my inner journey and public events, it's beginning to be coordinated. And I actually take various bits of challenge that are thrown my way by life and I work on it. And something comes out that makes me a richer person than I was going into it. Does that make some sense? Making enough sense for me to keep going, or should I? I mean, I'm going to give you examples of what I'm talking about, but is it sort of roughly in the ballpark? Any questions on it so far?
Is diversity in your life fit into that picture of wholeness and
well,
include that as part of the beauty?
I would include that as part of the beauty, but part of the growth, because very often the dissonance I might experience is because I've hit a diversity that actually stretched me beyond where I was at the moment. Make sense? So I think diversity is very important. If it remains a kind of a fragmented diversity, that's not good. So when I hit diversity, I'm hitting something that I didn't expect to hit, and it stretched me, and I don't have a model for it, so now I'm going to grow up.
I like that picture of diversity as part of beauty. If you think about the stunning kind of non-human world around us that God's made, I mean, it's staggering in terms of its incredible diversity. You think all the birds that I can never figure out which one's which, you know, parakeets and whatever they are, I always get them wrong, but, you know, all those really colourful birds, you know, and colourful fish and stuff, and it's kind of riotous, you know, almost, and I kind of wonder sometimes if beauty, part of beauty isn't it, that somehow there is some extraordinary coherence that just lets you have joy, even when the diversity seems bewildering at times, but it's not chaotic.
It's rich and animated, rich.
So part of this thing of beauty has got to be uniqueness, I guess, is that the magnificent thing is that, you know, God doesn't want me to look like you, or you to look like someone else, or them to look like someone else.
I think it's very particular. Yeah, it's very particular. God wants to shine his glory into a particular state or situation. I just want to say that I am very seriously putting this point forward. What if we reframed the whole learning journey at God's great interest as making life beautiful? More beautiful than it was. What if that was his great intention? See, joy is a word I've had problems with. I thought joy was some kind of optional extra, like, would you like this with fries? You know, would you like life with a bit of joy? It's kind of stuck on the end after you've gone through all the suffering. That was the kind of mental model I had of joy. Edwards thought joy sluiced through the universe. Unbridled torrents of joy sluiced through the universe. That's God. He is not a God of restraint. So what if God wants to make life joyous, riotously joyous, and our job is to, you know, do that in our soul journey for our part? What if he wants us to, you know, what if we said, well, framing my life as increasingly, you know, beauty, that's not to say there aren't a lot of challenging times, but what if that was the frame? It's very, very thought-provoking.
At the most basic level, we didn't have diversity in the Godhead.
Powerful, very, very powerful point. And this is a really important point to contrast kind of the Christian worldview with the other great, you know, the Islamic worldview, which doesn't allow diversity. But we actually have diversity, hence the whole idea of dissonance and recreation. Sorry, John?
Can I ask how many people here have read Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek?
Yeah.
She won the Pulitzer Prize, her first novel.
Yes.
And it is just... it's magnificent. She trains herself to sit at a creek for 8 hours.
Wow.
And she's got a Calvinist-like ability to exegete creation. And she comes out with these magnificent sentences about this manic God who, you know, there's so many muscles on the back of a moth and all this incredible...
Isn't that great?
...rejoicing in diversity.
I love that manic God. So Annie...
Dillard.
Dillard, D-I-L-L-A-R-D, and it's called?
Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek.
Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek. Well, that's something I'm going to read.
Yeah, okay, good.
Good, thank you. So while we're on this subject of beauty, I'll now switch to an author who's hugely influenced me, and you know, in many ways, that design wave I got from. But he's not a Christian. His name is John Dewey, one of the great pragmatic philosophers, and he wrote this incredible paragraph on the beauty of having an experience, a designed experience, which is what he said: the Greek identification of good conduct with proportion, grace, and harmony is an example of a distinctive aesthetic, i.e. beauty quality, in moral action. Interesting phrase, let it sink in, aesthetics in moral action. One great defect in what passes as morality is its anesthetic quality. First time it's become obvious to me where the word anesthetic comes from, without beauty, because the an Greek means without, so it's without beauty. And yet we've come to something that kind of dulls you, is its anesthetic quality. Instead of exemplifying wholehearted action, it, that is morality, takes the form of grudging piecemeal concessions to the demands of duty. So he said, what if we imagined life and learning and good conduct? What is good conduct? So I'm not going to go to morality, I'm going to go to proportion, grace and harmony. I'm going to go to beauty. And saying good conduct is aesthetic. It's turning life beautiful. And of course, if you do it inwardly, you do it outwardly. And that morality too often shrinks to having nothing to do with the beauty side and is just some grudging, piecemeal, do this, don't do this. And you know, he could have been writing about Loyola in that. So let's go back to this learning. We call it the design wave in our firm, Second Road, and it dominates all we do. Just so you understand, I mean, the reason we have all these panels around the wall is there's a huge project around the wall, which is we were paid a lot of money to do by one of the largest corporations in Australia, and it's probably what's on the wall is probably worth $500 million conservatively in innovation that we have created for them in 4 months. We designed the whole thing around that icon on the board. So you know, when the boss was here and he got excited, he said, what would you do, Tony? I just sketched that up on the board and said, that's what we do. He said, great, let's do it. And that governed the 4 months' worth of work. So I'm not actually talking out of much theory on this. This is productive stuff. And we brought to this firm ideas like beauty, ideas like desire, ideas like humanising experience. So actually, the method is useful everywhere. I'm just using it tonight for our inner journey. So if I'm a Christian, I often think, yeah, I love this stuff, but what does my faith in God add to this? I think I'm invited to frame my intent around providence. You know, I'm not asked to view the river of life cynically or accidentally. You know, to some extent, underneath are the everlasting arms, and my life is not an accident. Even the accidents in my life, it's not an accident if I was born male or female. It's not an accident if I was born in a certain country. Take it seriously. And so I guess what I've learned to do is to take seriously and notice the river of experience I'm in. Take seriously and notice the river of experience I'm in. And that has to do with goals. And noticing dissonance and unease where I'm uncomfortable with how I'm handling something. For me, this is, as I said, a disjunction between my experience and inside myself and what's going on outside of myself. I then go into a process of exploration, but importantly, when I explore myself, and I'm intrigued by myself. So this, in the existential, and this is not to sound narcissistic, you are the object of your own unending fascination. It's generally what a jerk I am and how I think I'm smart, but I'm not. But it's a subject of bemusement, not blame, you know. Like, how dumb can you get, Tony? How many times are you going to take to learn this? Isn't it intriguing how slow you are to learn? But it's absolutely, what I've got up there is incredibly important. It's definitely my reactions and thoughts linked to events. But, you know, it can't, this is why the normative is important. My normative is I'm on a bedrock that Jesus finished everything as regards sin, and I'm not going back there. And no one is going to budge me off that rock-solid normative ground. It lets me do this very securely, because I'm not looking for sin. I have a very strong sense from the Bible of charismata, a very strong sense of the body. Now, the metaphor of the body is dominant in the New Testament. I think it is the best metaphor of organisational life I've ever come across, but I've never seen it in any book on organisational life. It essentially says the elbow is only an elbow, and it shouldn't whinge because it's not an eye. So I'm saying, well, part of my explanation is not going to be me whinging because I'm not an eye. And if I'm an elbow, that's all I am. So I have a very strong comfort with strengths and weaknesses. And I'm no longer looking for Superman. You know, I was when I was little. Hagiography, saints, you know, every saint I've ever looked after has clay feet at the end of the day, so I've thrown all that out. But I can securely explore strengths and weaknesses. And I absolutely know God has structured the universe and structured society so that he will not put all his eggs in one basket. We will never be self-sufficient, which means I'm going to find situations where I'm out of a depth. Does that make sense to you? But it's a matter of not me being sinful, but God wanting a body where I have to embrace diversity as part of the journey. Diversity in this case being somebody else. Now, the greatest act of diversity I had to embrace was my dear wife. She's not here tonight, so I can talk about it freely.
She's going to hear. Don't worry, she'll hear.
Yeah, she will. She will. She's starting to listen to these.
It's being taped.
Yes, it's being taped. She was going to transcribe them too, but... I told you, most people in my talks are very nice. Like, it was really great, Tony. I really enjoyed it. But could you just, you know, whereas I say, gee, she just leaves the entire first bit out and just goes straight. Look, you just really wander all over the shop. And it's just... So, you know, there's a fair amount of diversity in marriage that we get, which is interesting. But the idea that we've both got complementary gifts is very powerful. This discovery of the divine is interesting because this is, you get to heaven here, and this is where I do get mystical. And by the way, it's not just me getting mystical, but the high, you can see there's a vertical axis in the design wave. I'm going from left to right, but up. That's actually, I am going up as I go up towards more of the heavens, and I'm trying to search for models. And it's a great, great debate throughout all of literature. Where do the models come from? Where does form come from? From God or from us? It's a beautiful... it's a meeting in the middle to me. You know, where does music come from? Like, did we invent chords or are they out there in the ether, like in the sound waves? Like, where... And if, okay, but if they're out there, how come Indian music is different to our music? But you've got to say a chord's a beautiful thing of form, you know? So it's a mystery. And this is why I call this discovery of the divine. There's grace that happens here where... I think the Holy Spirit intervenes to say, Tony, I'm going to give you a gift of a new thought. Now, I know how invention happens. I know I need new thoughts. Cognitively it makes sense. But even when I view my own cognition, I feel I'm on holy ground. Really holy ground. Sorry, that sounds bad. When I view my cognition as the human experience, because it dominated Edwards's mind. Jonathan Edwards, the imagination thrilled him. In the 17th century, people began to really wonder about the imagination, and it thrilled them as kind of just, how is it that we human beings can make new stuff in our heads? How does this work? Do we just add one and one together and get two, or does something else happen? Does one and one become three? And Locke and David Hume and Coleridge argued about this. I'd love to talk about it more, but something great happens. Well, you know, I'm very confident this is the realm where we and the Holy Spirit dance together and he's given us new stuff. Now, let me just get practical about the normative. The more your mind is filled with the scriptures, the more bits and pieces the Holy Spirit can play with to bring ideas to your head. Does that make some sense? If you have never bothered to educate yourself, if you've never said, I'm going to read Deuteronomy and I'm going to read Ezekiel and it's boring as all get out, but I'm going to try. If you don't do that, you never get anything into your head. All that's in your head is other vacuous stuff. So this is where the normative feeds the existential. Yeah, the more bits there are in your head from memory. Remember, Loyola said memory is one of the ingredients. So memory, the Holy Spirit can use memory. So I really fear for modern young Christians who are so illiterate about the Bible. So, and then I will take this thought and play it out in my action. So that's the journey. So I structure this essentially by journals, the writing process, and these are my most precious possessions. These are cool. You can buy them in Rome only. It's a great shop 2 blocks up from the Parthenon. But it's beautiful. Just feel that paper. Isn't that beautiful? That's the Italians rescued paper, actually, in the monasteries, and it's gorgeous. And so these, so I just buy these. You can get them on the internet if you want to buy them there. I recommend you go to Rome and get it. It's much more fun. I keep the cover, and so this is. I have several of these journals. This one, the small one, is my inner journey. This is my, you know. This is my inner journey one. I have one for work where I actually capture all the conversations I have. So,
can you filled out already?
This one?
Yeah, can you make me one?
The important thing is that language is our primary tool for thought. Doing stuff, you know, to go along that way with language is really important. And in language, writing is our most advanced modality. We have 4 modalities of language: listening, reading, speaking, and writing. Without going too much into it, writing is by far the most difficult because I've got to put stuff together, instruction, connection, bits, right here. So if I force myself to write, my mind is getting disciplined. So it's very, very, from a Loyalan point of view of exercise, it really works, as opposed to just staring at the ceiling and smoking dope or something. That's not the meditation we're talking about. This is kind of hard work meditation. So writing crystallizes thought. It doesn't just help us communicate. There's a world of meaning behind that sentence, but that's exactly what we actually, if I write stuff in my journal, I'm actually the only audience for most of this journal. But it's a very valuable way of me just taking thoughts and moving them ahead. The examples I show you might go over 2 pages, but I'm actually going on a journey. I'm mapping a whole journey from that exploration phase to the, you know, hoping to get something phase to the so what phase. I'm not just mapping a finished product. It's more a journey. So this is pretty messy, as a matter of fact. There's a very good example. So on the we use what's called spider diagramming, which is the way to explore thoughts, and I'll just show you tonight. I'd love to teach it to you, but it's very close to how your mind works by neural connection. So that's me exploring, I think, Psalm 40. And then I had a few ahas out of that, and then I wrote. So this is early. I wonder what's going on, and this is, I think this is going on. This looks good. And all the topics I choose to write about here are, to some extent, ambiguous, unknown, and a bit confusing to me when I start. Does that make sense? So this is about, they're all about explorations. I'll give you an example. This is a little domestic example. I got the word little in italics because, you know, I think in God's universe, nothing's little. I don't think God's a volume guy. So I could be the President of America meditating on a day with Cabinet, or I could be just me thinking about playing with my grandkids. And I think God's just completely agnostic to the scale of those things. So anything is little in God's world. This is one I actually did deliberately, in the sense that I thought, as I was preparing this, I thought, well, if this works, I should just be able to turn this on and off. So I'd had a day, and this is the day, so here it goes. It's actually quite interesting where it came up to. There's quite a lot of discovery in it, which is fun. I always start with initiating context. I have a line, bang, 24th of June, initiating context. What happened was we got dumped with the grandkids. Happens a lot. The more grandkids you get, the more you get dumped with them, which is lovely, but, you know, Sarah's having a tough day. You get the phone call at 8 a.m., and we kind of, yes, we'll come in, we'll rescue. It's great, except I was going to play golf that day, and I had promised myself that I was going to do some writing that day, and my plan just got junked. But I'm good, so I don't let myself say that to Sarah. Just sulk. Yeah, I'm a good sulker, actually. That's my reaction to things. Very good at that passive aggressive. So I explore my feelings linked to the event. And these are my feelings. So this is how I do a spider diagram. It's not all perhaps that clear, but lost time. I want to write an article. Let's be honest, Tony. You know, you're a bit cranky about that. We went to the museum. I don't like museums. And I actually kind of, this is time and place. The skeletons, like Finn loves skeletons, so I've got to kind of share the love of skeletons. I know, like skeletons. I have this kids' play area, you know, the kids, have anyone been to the museum? They have this kids' play area, like it's really good, but I'm just frankly bored. And so these are two beautiful little things of 4 and 6, right, Finn and Edie. And I just get tired. It's Saturday, I've had a big week. I'm just not there. And I zone out. I try to hide this from Anne, but it's not even worth the effort. Like, because she's in there with these kids, like, inside the little tents and playing with them, and I'm just sitting thinking about the contract we just won or, you know, and or I'm just not there. It's too petty for me. I just like talking about big stuff, not little stuff. And kind of an ennui, this is a dark side of my character, you know, this kind of sense of torpor. I'm actually, I think a lot of guys, you know, I live an adrenaline-filled life. And I kind of can't, if I move out of it, I just flop. I don't want to be disturbed, I don't want to talk to anybody. And I can't do domestic. You know, and Anne says, they're your grandkids. Like, get a life. So this is my inner journey. Do you see what I mean? Stuff. So I was also, for a period, I was abandoned. This is Home Alone. Because she went shopping and said, can I take care of the two kids? Fine, no problem. So I had these, and I just became aware of this burden of many little domestic decisions. Like, Grandpa, can we have a sandwich with peanut butter on? I'm thinking, does this break some rule? I don't know. I'm arguing with a four-year-old over whether they can have a sandwich. I'm frightened of doing the wrong thing. I have to multitask, getting them dressed. My God, I have no idea where the clothes are. Do they know where the clothes are? In the end, they're helping me. And I am just keeping it together. So this was my experience. So I look for some insights around this, you know, reflections emerge that offer me some insight about me or the circumstance. And as I did, a couple of things occurred to me. One was C.S. Lewis. I just remembered that actually it is true that he was, he spent a lot of time taking care of, I think, the children of his nieces or nephews, and a lot of his ideas came when he was in the middle of these domestic chores. And so this sort of struck me with, well, perhaps I'm missing something here, you know. Perhaps I'm missing something here. And the other thing that struck me, I began to meditate on the nature of engagement, because I don't like being disengaged. I don't like kind of, you know, looking at you and you say something and I'm not even listening to the sentence, so I've got to frantically try and grab the last word you say and say something intelligent so you think I was listening to your sentence, but I wasn't even there. As I say, this works for everybody, but with my wife, it's just not worth the effort. So, but what I thought about, so I kind of have a sense of I wish I wasn't like that, but the right says disengage, but life's details are engaging. And there's a decision, if you make the decision to engage, perhaps the feelings will follow, because what I've written is engagement is not a commodity. I said, Tony, I think you're thinking about energy. No, energy was my problem. It's not a commodity that you either have or don't have. It's more a decision initiated by a decision to engage. So if I, rather than sitting at the edge of the kids' play area, I had decided to get myself up and go into the tent with the bloody little dinosaur skeletons, I might have had some fun. And I might have found myself getting, you know, so this is, well, perhaps it's not a death sentence to, you know, have your personality and something can be done with it. So this is kind of going up the wave a little bit. And as for discovering the divine in my experience, by this time because I'm actually saying, you know, I'm taking grandparenting seriously, I'm taking life seriously, I'm going to find the divine in my experience. It's Rumours of Glory, which is a great title of a song by
Bruce Coburn.
Bruce Coburn, yeah. It just suddenly hit me about Jesus and the children, that he did not. I mean, he would have been right in there at the museum. And actually, he rebuked his disciples because they were rather like me, you know, and such as the kingdom of God. And I then began to, because I just went back to these kids, and what they had is this wonder at life. I mean, Finn has a wonder about skeletons. I'm the one who's bored at skeletons, not him. Like, for him, it's just a phenomenal mystery, and he thinks it's fabulous. But interestingly, I think a lot of people would be reading about the kids, like, you know, that is if kids never ask questions. They ask questions the whole time, going back to learning. That they never stop. That was my problem. Questions, questions, questions. And Jesus said, of such is the kingdom of heaven. The point is they trust the answers, not that they don't ask the questions. Does that make sense? It all just hit me. That's it. It's not a God who doesn't want us to ask. He wants us to ask hundreds of questions. He just wants us to trust. And they trust me. If I, because, you know, they're asking me about skeletons. What do I know? But the poor dear little things believe me, you know. I realise Jesus is not referring to their innocence at all. They squabble, they bitch. He's actually referring to their confidence and their learning journey. So all this came out when I just looked at this, and this is where the divine came in. I don't know what made me think of Jesus and the children. But as I was going through this meditation, suddenly it hit me, of such as the kingdom. And of course, it hit me because it's in my memory, because I've read it a lot. Mm-hmm. But if it wasn't there and I'd never read the story, I couldn't do this. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so I'm getting an analogy where I'm finding kind of a connection with Jesus in my life that's inspiring for me and points a way forward. So I said, I wrote this out. For me, I learned a few things today, and I really did. And this first one actually stuns me. There's something very maternal in God. With, you know, I've got a very kind of masculine view of God, but as far as, you know, the kid, he's actually more like Anne than I am. God is very maternal in his engagement and the mental model. It really hit me. The nature of faith, which I just talked about, and then the stretch of answering questions, that I have to use metaphors to answer questions. This is what's such a struggle for me, is to, because I can't explain. So, you know, part of the fights I had with them was over the fact that Finn had worked out that he had not got as many presents as Edie. And I was having to try to explain to Finn, you can't quantify love, mate. It's not fair to count up. And, you know, so, but I can't actually use the phrase, you can't quantify love. So I've got to go to some sort of metaphor to communicate to him. And I think, well, probably this is the problem God's got with us. You know, that we ask questions that he's struggling to answer because of our dumb little minds. So this was a rich little experience for me. So that was about an hour across the way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, just talking about your connection to the scriptures, actually, sort of.
Yes.
The scriptures are a situation. The other day, they were talking about Lisa Curry being 49 years of age and hoping to get pregnant. And the wife said, that's ridiculous. She said, a woman of age should not expect to get pregnant. So I said, well, I said, Sarah, but about 90 if she got pregnant.
Yeah.
And all I did was get this look. What's that? What's
the difference?
So maybe you need to keep these things to yourself.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I say keep your own journal. I never said show it to your wife.
She might have been worried about the conclusion you were going to draw.
Yeah.
So did you take your journal to the museum?
And you're no. No, I look, in practice, I try. I just do it. I've got a time-saving problem because I go to the gym in the morning and I've got no time. So I've now decided, I prayed about this and the obvious thing hit me, we'll do it at lunchtime, perhaps 3-4 times a week. But it's always, it's not at the event, it's just a time where I'm thinking over something.
It's interesting as I'm listening to all this, because I've just finished doing a master's in education and done a psychology subject, where we've been looking at, you know, performance goals versus mastery goals, and what does failure mean? And because you mentioned, Mark, performance, I'm thinking how Christianity, particularly evangelicalism, is very performance-based, incredibly performance-based. And I think children, and you describing your grandchildren here, I'm listening to that and going, that inquisitiveness is mastery-based. It's hugely mastery-based. But they learn to forget about that and become performance-based, because our whole society is getting one up on somebody else and beating somebody else and climbing the career ladder. It's all performance-based. And so I'm sitting here wondering, you know, when you mentioned at the beginning about Genesis and performance, I thought, you know, when Jesus talks about how we're not under law, we're under grace, is he talking about we're not under that performance thing? Are we under that mastery thing, which your grandchildren know, to ask questions and be inquisitive and to grow, and that growth is about, you know, where the failures are no longer a measure of your success or your performance. Your failures are part of that learning journey.
Yes. I think you're right on the money, and I love the phrase that... mastery, because I think I haven't got this here, one of the verses I was going to have, which is, to me is very important, is Ephesians 4, where Paul has the phrase of growing up into Christ, because I think that's the journey that we're actually asked to go on to, which is a mastery.
Yeah.
But the really sad thing, sorry, what was your name?
Marie.
The sad thing, Marie, is that I think people would expect the Christians in the class to go to the performance side rather than Christianity to be the ones that actually explicates the mastery side.
One of the places I love in Paul, I think really brings home what you were saying, is that when you think about, it's a bigger topic to talk about this whole, you know, flesh-spirit thing that Paul talks about, which is not two parts of us, but two modes of being human, but I think map well across the two trees. And in Galatians 5, you know, he says that, you know, famous passage about the fruit of the Spirit, you know, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. You look at those things, they're not performance-based things at all.
No.
Not in the least. They're all relational. They're every single one of them. It makes no sense except in relation to another person. And about a transparency, an indwelling, and engaging, and encountering, you know, with another human being. And Paul finishes it by saying, against these things there's no law. And given the contrast he's painted in the whole book, I think what he's saying is not oh gee, if you go around, you know, trying to love lots and trying to peace lots and trying to joy lots, you'll find out, I managed to tick off all the laws. But rather it's a life characterized by those things, like the two trees, has no reference to law. It needs no reference to law. It's of another order. And it is this, you know, mastery is a lovely word in one context. It's this thing Tony's talking about here. And it's, in one sense, you know, if you think about, you can look at this, I think, and you sort of think, oh, but isn't, where's the bit that says somewhere I'm deficient? And somehow I've got to be addressing where I'm deficient. Maybe one way, is, you know, if there's any value in that at all, is to think, where am I still hooked into performance? Where is that still manifest in my life, that I'm hooked into this whole mindset, and God by His Spirit is trying to lead me out of that?
I think that's really powerful. So that's an example. Does it bring it to life? So what I've got is just I wanted to finish off. I'll give you a couple of other quick ones, but they'll be quick. Is that the stamina for another 10 minutes? So the other examples really happened in the sense that I didn't decide, oh, well, I'll learn. These other examples took place over years, to be honest. They were bigger journeys for me. So one context is my role as the CEO of a company. And I'm not a born CEO, but I am the CEO of a company that we founded. That's it's quite a significant company, employed between 20 and 30, up to 40 people, and punches way above our weight. I've had a kind of a, in terms of the public journey and inner journey, a bit of a, is this me or not part of the journey? I'm more the artist, I'm more the thinker, I'm more the philosopher. I'm quite entrepreneurial and I like making tons of money, but I'm not really a structure guy, if that makes some sense. I'm sure it makes a lot of sense to anyone who knows anything about me. This leads to dissonance, and it was framed to me by a friend of mine, a great mentor in the US, who actually said to me inquisitively one day, because he was watching me, he wanted me to build a company for years and I wasn't doing it. And he asked me this question, it was actually on a phone call, he said, Tony, do you have trouble giving people orders. And I knew he was right. I just knew he'd really pinned it. I don't like giving people orders. I'm actually very strong-minded, but I don't like giving people orders. I just think you're a jerk, and it's my private thing. The words don't come out of my mouth, and I just go my own way. And I realised there was something in me that wasn't really... I had either a mental model of giving orders or whatever, but I knew that was true, that there was therefore a distance between my role. And so I spent time exploring. I wonder why I'm like this. I wonder what my personality is. I wonder, and various models can help in this. But essentially, I'm not taking this as a sin. I mean, you can tell by the example that there's no way that this fits sin. But it was certainly quite dominating in my life. And I'm wondering, is this me? Is this not me? What's it mean? Etc. I realised I was probably grappling with models. I don't have this here because it was a long journey. More performance-based models, perhaps. Command-control models of what it means to be the boss of a system, where you say no to people, and you tell people to do this, not that, and you decide their salaries, and you do all sorts of stuff I prefer not to do. I didn't go on this journey on my own. This is with my wife, is very much an ingredient in, I think, getting me through it. But the real breakthrough came in terms of divine discovery. I was reading a book, O'Sullivan. Is that Tom Wright's friend? I keep forgetting the political...
O'Donovan.
In O'Donovan, it's a very complicated book, but there was a section I was reading it on authority versus power. And he pulled the two words apart and essentially talked about power and authority, very different. And it's a hugely important difference. The sense of, power is more the total, creational, don't stand in my way type of view of God. And that might, and the Romans pulled the two words apart too, between power. But authority was more that there's a zone, and within that zone, the prince governs within that zone. So if the prince runs the city, then the authority zone are the walls of the city. And suddenly, for the first time in my life, a lot of things started to make sense to me, including the bits in Romans where he talks about authority. That actually, I realised that we human beings did not invent the concept of authority. It's a bit like music. It's a God thing to run a social system, which means that the way to run the social system is that there's got to be authority around its boundaries. And somebody has to carry that authority, otherwise the thing falls apart. And providentially, then if you're in a certain system, you've got the voice of authority for that system. The family is a great example. The family is a system where somebody needs, the boundaries of authority. And I realised that my company was an authority zone. And if I abdicated within that zone, the leadership, then no one was going to do it. Doesn't mean I'm a leader everywhere, but within that, it just gave me a mental model I was much more comfortable with. Does that make sense? I could see myself inhabiting that model of giving people direction. I could see if I didn't, I was defeating the whole system because it needed me to do that. So, my inner journey was one of getting a bigger picture of my role that's now actually was very much a divine discovery that amplified my sense of the role. And rather than me just carrying in my head probably performance-based concepts I'd got from somewhere, I had a more godly concept of the role. And I could see myself in that role now much more happily. That gave me a lot of relaxation in conflict, which essentially was, for various people, I could say, look, you don't have to agree with what I'm saying, but this is the sandpit I've got authority over, and if it really doesn't suit you, then take that seriously and go and plant another sandpit, and let's really respect each other. And we've had wonderful, mature conversations around that, because it just happens to be this is the sandpit that I've happened to have authority over, and it just took a lot of the emotion out of stuff. Do you see what I mean? So That's a pretty big sandpit for me along me in life. Another one is really an interesting one because this is an intellectual journey, and Dewey does make the point that some of these journeys are intellectual. In other words, we've got theological problems, and this is relevant to gospel conversations. Obviously, we've rejoiced in the new creation gospel, and it de-emphasises sin. No two ways about it. That's what we've talked about tonight. And for years, Mark and I and others have been on this journey. Where's the dissonance come in that? The dissonance for me has come, where does this leave evangelism? Because when I had the simple model that you're a sinner, you're going to hell, I had a very simple message to tell you, but now I don't even know if I believe in hell. I'm not quite sure it just I'm going to start from not the difference between us, but our creational connection. So at what stage in this conversation do I break off to say, oh, by the way, you're going to hell? You know what I mean? So to be honest with you, I found that what was actually happening was I thought I'd lost something because I love evangelism. I couldn't work out what's the message. What's the evangelical message out of the creational gospel? Does that make sense? And for me, that was something, you know, for a while, these things gnaw away at me and I don't voice them. After a while, they become clear enough that I can voice them. And this is quite a recent journey, this one I've been on. And this new thought came to me from actually just the name of Tom Wright's book, which is When God Became King, which I'm reading and I love the book, but actually the title did all the work for me. What came into my mind again from the memory was that plus all authority is given to me in heaven and earth. Go into all the world and make disciples. And I realised that what I really believe now is he is king. And what you do with kings is you take them very, very seriously and you ignore them at your peril. And so I could say to people I've got with whom I declared connection, look, there's a king, you know. He's a king because he rose from the dead, so please take him seriously. My declaration of what I want you to do is very clear to me. Just acknowledge he's king. Okay, now I know that's Acts 17. That's what Acts 17 does, by the way. That's the first sermon we have to a totally Gentile audience. If it's not the first, it's certainly the major one. Very much worthwhile studying. Can anyone guess what Paul never mentions when he's talking to the Greeks? He never mentions sin, and he never mentions the cross. He never mentions anything about Jesus dying. Totally different sermon to Peter, you know, talking to the Jews. What he does talk about is the resurrection. And therefore, he is king and obey him to people who thought Caesar was king. So I realise this is a declaration I can make to people. I won't go into all of it, but you see what I mean? It was a journey where I felt the Holy Spirit helped me through it and came to a much, you know, an authentic new place. So they're just some other more recent type of journeys that I have been on.
Tony, it's interesting. I've been sort of waiting for this for about half an hour. You'll hear it. One of the things that happens is that when we talk about baptism, the picture we've been getting for a long, long time, it's washing of sin. Rubbish. It's not. What it is going down to death and coming up to life. And what you've been talking about is coming up to life. You haven't been talking about washing away sin. And the very issue, I mean, you can actually see it, this is something which permeates a lot of our sort of very core way of operating in churches. This wrong picture, that it's at the very start of Christianity, it's the wrong picture to start with.
Exactly. That's why I went back to Loyola. Once you begin with sin, everything goes on this cleansing journey, which takes you down a path you can't get off. But this is life. This is growing as people.
There's enormous anxiety built into this picture, in this traditional picture. And I think there's an obsessiveness. It's almost like if I'm not anxious enough, I need to be really anxious, really, really troubled. One of the great ironies to me, I mean, it's more than an irony, but is, you know, it, particularly in this city and a lot of the traditions that have been so helpful in so many other ways, is we've trumpeted the idea of justification by faith, you know, that we stand before God on the basis of what Christ has done for us, which I'm heart and soul for, so is Tony. But, you know, I actually think that in practice, how that is actually translated is we are justified on how well we are able to articulate our justification. So let me give you a picture. If it is actually the work of Christ, okay, if that is the basis of now of the end of sin, the end of threat, the end of judgment, the end of death for me, and of the Father's open-heartedness to me, but it is all entirely the finished work of Christ, then conceivably, you know, it's no difficulty that at some point in my my journey of faith, I've got very little comprehension of what that means. I don't really get it. I don't really get how that worked and how did Jesus do this on my behalf. And I'm not sure that I can say it very well, you know, and probably if I try to say it, it's going to come out sort of heretical, you know. Somebody who knows better will say, oh, gee, don't say that. No, that's wrong, you know. And you think, well, gee, if I said it wrong, does that mean I'm not justified? You know, it's like, no, it's the work of Christ, not how well I can articulate it. And of course, all these years later, you know, am I the full bottle on it? Well, of course not. Is it still fundamentally mysterious to me? Yeah, of course it is. And even though, you know, I've soaked in the scriptures a long time and looked at these things a lot and whatever, is there still places where I just go, I don't know, I'm just very thankful, you know. But I think it's come out as this notion of like, no, what really, we don't say it, but it's not fundamentally, it's all settled on what Christ has done. Because if that was the case, we would accept each other on the basis of what Christ has done. But we end up, in fact, accepting each other on how well we can articulate what we think it is that Christ has done for us. So if I can't give, you know, the really, you know, schmick version of what justification by faith is, I can't explain it like that, then all of a sudden I become suspect to another person as to, am I actually truly of Christ? You see what I'm saying? And so I think the whole thing around the Lord's Supper and stuff that we experience, I mean, it's just bizarre to me, this kind of sitting in this introspection, going through this whole thing until there's this moment of relief when I finally had the bread and the wine, and we stop the kind of heaviness and, oh, I can sing a song that's a bit happier, you know? And you think, like, am I really standing in that moment of profound anxiety as the man is dying on the cross, wondering what the hell is going on, is this going to be all right? Or am I actually standing on the other side of the resurrection and looking back? And so that, in fact, it's an experience of joy, the entire thing, where the anxiety has been lifted off me, not because of I've done a fantastic self-help job on myself, but because that is the Spirit's... It's almost like, you know, could it possibly be true that the Spirit's work is to lift anxiety off me about my sin and all the rest of it?
Mm.
You know, as I, you know, I thought some time ago, I don't think the Spirit's job is to fix us. I don't think the Spirit's trying to fix me. I think the Spirit's trying to transform me. And part of the transformation is letting go of this whole performance thing.
And learning by failure.
And one of the things I love, Tony, about all the stuff you've been saying here is just this notion of, you know, you mean I could really ask all those sort of questions? I can have all the doubts. I can have the sense of dissonance. I can laugh at myself. Yeah.
Mm. And of course, the Psalms are a perfect example. I mean, we really don't. We have a scripture that has, you know, 150 songs, at least half of which are full of questions, doubts, and challenges. And so God is clearly authorizing it. He wants a conversation with us. And that's another way of looking at this, is conversations with God. Because, I mean, we, whilst I've charted this as an inner journey, I have a companion on the inner journey, who is the Holy Spirit, who's clearly, in a mystical, hard-to-describe way, helping me on this journey. But I've got a part to play by structuring it. And I think, yes, we're growing. We're just growing through this on the other side of the resurrection. So I think what we're doing in conclusion is linking heaven and earth. I won't go into this, but this is really the Platonic model versus the Jewish model, which is pretty powerful, but I think would be obvious from what we're talking about. And I'll finish on this. I think in this meditation, what I'm doing is building the house of God on earth. One of my favourite stories in the Bible is Bethel. In a sense, it's a wonderful story where Jacob is wandering through the land and he's out in the desert. He's stateless. He doesn't know where he is. He's not in a place he owns. The place is arid. And he sleeps and he has a dream. And in the dream, he sees a stairway that is linking heaven and earth, the feet resting on earth and the top ascending to heaven, and he sees the angels of God ascending and descending on it. It's a phenomenal picture. And he wakes up and he says, surely God was in this place and I knew it not. And he names it the house of God. And really what I think that I want to say in conclusion is that what each of these journeys were for me were, wow, surely God was in this place and I knew it not. Surely God was in the museum with the kids and I knew it not. Surely God was in being a CEO and I knew it not. And like Jacob, I saw it and he was there. And yes, he had things to say to help me about kids and museum and skeletons and, you know, like the lady looking at the river. He's just this manic God whose creation is shot through with himself. And to finish with a wonderful quote from a great book by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Cancer Ward, which I love. At such moments, the whole meaning of existence was conjured up in his mind. This is an old doctor reflecting back on his life. He did not see it as embodied in the work or activity which occupied people by which they were known to others. The meaning of existence was to preserve untarnished, undisturbed and undistorted the image of eternity, which each person is born with, like a silver moon in a calm, still pond. It's a beautiful sense that there's divinity and eternity within each of us, and our job, he's probably presenting it more passively than I would. Our job is not to screw it up, but I'd say our job is to build on it. But it's a very much a Bethel type of a model that runs through that wonderful book, that we've got eternity within. So that's the end of the existential journey. Our next couple of months will really be taken up with John Walton, so we won't have gospel conversations during that time. When we come back, Ron's going to take some talks for us on some interesting material on the role of the cross. Do you want to just quickly foreshadow what the rough thought you had? Or is it too early?
It's too early.
Okay. He's going to go to the kind of controversial side, where's the role of the cross in this and some other stuff, which, as we know how you think, Ron, we'll look forward to it. Okay, thanks for coming, guys. Thanks very much. Yeah, you can give me a clap.